To go back a bit, when you talk about Boomer Hope as a captain,
well, he was a fine chap. Personally, he was not the least intellectual, but he was popular with the ship's company, and I wouldn't say that he was even especially efficient as an officer, but he was respected by his present personality, and we only had him for a short time because he was already appointed elsewhere to go to be an ordnance officer, INO, of course, and so he left, and we got I think one of the finest professional officers the Canadian Navy ever produced, Harry DeWolfe, and he had a great flair for operations and seemed to always do well in anything he attempted, and he in May 1940 we came in from one of our convoys and to Halifax as usual, and we were told to embark extra ammunition and return to sea, and while we were got to sea the ship's company was assembled, and Harry DeWolfe told us that we were bound for Plymouth,
yeah,
because of the fall of France, or the invasion of the Low Countries at least had already started, and we had DeWolfe until Lay
led you across.
Yes.
We went
across.
It was Lay and Restigouche, Harry DeWolfe in Saint-Laurent, and Jimmy Hibbard in Skeena.
Yeah, so the three of us went across together, and we got into Plymouth and had our armament changed, increased anti-aircraft armament, and then we got involved in the evacuation from France, so I'm proud of the fact that I've escorted our armies both ways across the English Channel, coming out in 40 and going back again in 44.
That's very that's good. Well, talk a bit more about Harry DeWolfe as a captain.
Well, he had the great respect of the ship's company because of his sheer professional acumen. He was a very good ship handler and so obviously knew his stuff from the tactical operational point of view, and that he had the automatic respect, even though he was rather a bit gruff and distant from the men and not as in some ways as warm a personality as Adrian Hope had been, but it was simply his obvious shining efficiency that he had the ship's company in the palm of his hand. As a result, they were the sort of fellow you would go anywhere with.
Yes. Talk about Nelson Lay as captain in those years. Did you see much of him?
Not very much. He was a very energetic fellow, but he did not shine in operationally. I don't think he had any especially good record at sea during the war. Nelson Lay's biggest contribution in his career, to my mind, was he was a first-class management man at naval headquarters.
Yes,
he was very good from the staff point of view, and one of the few executive officers who really understood the machinery of the bureaucracy of the public service and the military, and knew the system of annual estimates and their preparation inside out.
Do you know what Harry DeWolfe is most proud of? I've done interviews with him, he's much more inclined to talk at length about the time when he was on the staff in Ottawa and laid down the foundations for our new destroyers.
Yeah.
He figured out the estimates and placed the orders,
yes,
and he's more proud of that than his channel time.
Yes.
But he did do that, and he says, and we started the war with 6 modern destroyers.
Hmm.
That's Harry DeWolfe's words. And Lay called him as DOD, Director of the Operation Division.
Well, DeWolfe was a man, and happily still is, who was just bursting with ability. Anything he turned his hand to, he could do well. He could be a good staff officer. He could be a good captain afloat. He was very well coordinated, and was good at any athletics he took part in as well.
Before we go on to the Dunkirk actions, you've mentioned some other names. Talk about Jimmy Hibbard as captain of Skeena.
Well, again, he was a very likable fellow, but quite emotional and excitable. But of course, he the proof of the pudding is in the eating. He also had a first class war record in the Skeena and the Iroquois, and while I wouldn't put him in the same bracket as the Wolf, he was an outstanding officer, and also he was I would say that he was more conscious of his the welfare of his men than the Wolf was.
I think I'd agree with that from what I've been told. Yeah. I never served with him. Jumping Jimmy, he was called. He was very excited. He still is. You'll see him here. He's still very active.
Well, fellow, yeah.
Yeah. Talk about young Jock Rutherford.
Larry
Rutherford, yeah. Who was the 2 platoon commander.
Yes. Well, he was a very able officer, and it was a tragic loss to his Navy when he was killed and after his ship was torpedoed in 1942 in the old Ottawa. He was a first class fellow.
And Johnny Stubbs.
And Stubbs, likewise. The last time I always liked John Stubbs. I guess he was 5 or 6 years older, but we always seemed to hit it off together and be friends. And the last time I saw him was on board the Duke of York in Scapa Flow, and he was captain of the Athabasca, and I was a brand new captain of escort destroyer Chaudière, formerly HMS Hero, which had just arrived in Scapa Flow for workups, and the Duke of York had just got back. This was, I guess, would have been about New Year's 44, or very late 43, and just got back from sinking the Scharnhorst, and all the commanding officers were invited aboard to drink some of Admiral Fraser's champagne, the commander in chief, and the only Canadians present were Johnny Stubbs and myself, and we had a pleasant chat, making snide remarks about the British, and that was the last time I saw him. Mm-hmm. Again, a great loss to the Navy, because he would have been an outstanding officer later on in the Navy.
I was in the home fleet about that time with Eric Bogue driving Sioux.
Yes,
I was gunner for Sioux. And you were driving Chaudière,
yeah.
And you came and visited us one day, and you wore a Burberry. And you know, Pat, you always looked about 18 when you were about 26. I saw this boat approach with some indifference. There was obviously a very young officer in the stern sheets, and when you came over the side, you said, may I see the captain, please? And I damn near said, what business have you got with our captain? And then some inner instinct warned me, and I showed you up there, but I nearly put my foot in it and said, what is a snotty like you asking to see the captain for?
Yes.
I wanted to cover those names because they're big in our naval folklore,
yes.
Rutherford and Stubbs, and the other names, Lay and Hibbard. So you're taking people off from France.
Yes, it was a period, of course, of total dislocation and confusion. We were in and out of different ports along the south coast of England, and often was the vaguest instructions as to what to do, but we, the Restigouche and ourselves, got off Saint-Valery
en Côte,
and we were supposed to evacuate the 51st Highland Division, and they held out and were mostly taken prisoner, I think, as a result. So Lieutenant Nixon was eventually sent ashore in charge of our motorboat and two whalers to evacuate what troops they were, who are all, as it turned out, just a handful of completely demoralized French soldiers who were understandably demoralized because they'd been fighting the latest German tanks with 1911 Hotchkiss rifles, and we got them aboard our boats, and all the townsfolk of the village were down on the beach too, and old ladies in black dresses knelt down before me, begging to be taken off, but I was hard-hearted, and there was obviously no point in taking off. We wanted to get the soldiers, and I don't know whether even the soldiers we brought off helped the cause very much, because they were so demoralized that they, a lot of them threw their rifles into the sea as soon as they got into our boats. And however, I can't even remember the exact number that we picked off. I don't think it was more than 40 or 50 or so.
You had a motorboat and two waders.
Yes, probably about 50, and we eventually got them back to England. But we'd no sooner got them aboard and our boats hoisted when some German field guns arrived on the cliffs of St. Valery and started firing at us. And we were such innocents and lambs for the slaughter. You know, we saw these splashes near the ship of their shells, and we, you know, it took a while to dawn on us and say, "My God, they're firing at us! You know, what a mean thing to do!" And so we fired back and zigzagged and made smoke screens, and we weren't hit, and I doubt if we hit anybody ashore either. But that was, to the best of my belief, the first action of the Royal Canadian Navy. I think it was the first time any guns had been fired in anger.
That's right. You were the first ship in the Canadian Navy to fire at the Germans.
Yes.
Yeah. You can dine out on that story.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you left there and went back, I guess, to Plymouth.
We went back to Plymouth, and we were back on the French coast again, and we didn't evacuate any more troops or do anything very much. It was in memory, it was a time of great disorganization, inevitably, and we were attacked by enemy planes, but the only planes we fired at turned out to be our own, that sort of thing, and also it was my first experience of losing sleep. I remember we had virtually no sleep for two nights in a row, and even in your early 20s, you realize how useless you are. So you just can't do anything. And I remember Bob Welland; he was a shipmate, and we were both young lieutenants. I remember we were trying to have a conversation, and he'd fall asleep, and then I'd fall asleep. You know, we were just sort of not there.
Tragic days for us, those. How long did this go on, and then where did you go?
That went on for a few, I don't think it went on for more than a couple of weeks or so, yeah. Maybe 3 weeks. And then...
Wasn't Caldwell your first lieutenant?
Caldwell was the first lieutenant,
so
Frank Caldwell.
Frank, so the Arandora Star comes in here.
Yes, well that was, I think before that, I remember we were told to rendezvous with the Hood, battle cruiser Hood, and with some other British destroyers, and we formed a screen in the usual way and set out to sea. Typical of those days, we hadn't the faintest idea of what it was all about. And I think eventually Harry de Wolf sent us on a private signal to the captain of the Hood and said, you know, where are we going and when do we expect to get there? And it was all very secret. And our business was to meet a huge convoy of all the latest British liners carrying Australian troops, first expeditionary force to the UK, and we escorted them safely in.
These were Australian troops, right?
Yes, yeah. And probably New Zealand,
yeah.
For all I recall. And then we were out at sea, and we were supposed to be heading for Gibraltar, I forget why, but on the way we heard about this Arandora Star, an ocean liner full of German and Italian internees who were being sent to Canada with a British military guard as well. They were torpedoed, and we went to their rescue. The ship sank by the time we got there, and we had this amazing sight of a sort of floating island of lifeboats and people clinging to rafts in the middle of the, I suppose it was a few hundred miles off the coast of Ireland, and we spent our time keeping a wary eye for U-boats, and by lookouts and so on, stopping to pick up these boats, we had no idea what the personnel of this ship was composed of, but we soon found out, and there was this jumble of the ship's crew, the military guard, and the Germans and the Italians, and we picked up, I think it was 861. Anyway, it was the largest ocean rescue by a ship of that size during the whole war. And fortunately, the ocean was fairly calm. It was just a light swell, because we had such a load of people that the ship was quite unstable, and if you altered course too hard, you almost capsized with the weight of them. But it was a strange thing happened by fortunate coincidence. Was just prior to the rescue, something had gone wrong with our refrigerators, and they decided to cook all the meat, because to make it last longer cooked than it would, of course, if it had been raw and unrefrigerated. And this was going on just at the time we were told to go and rescue these people, so we had the food for them in the pot, as it were. And we only had them aboard less than 24 hours, but there wasn't a scrap of food left in the ship. The first thing we had to do before we even refueled was to get food on board. Mm-hmm. And anyway, we got into Greenock, Firth of Clyde, Tail of the Bank, and I was the navigator of the ship, and I remember we hadn't. Been into Greenock, and we didn't have the search channels on the charts through the minefields, and I had these charts were in my cabin aft, and I remember the ship was just black with people, and I had to get my way through, and I got into the after canopy and the after superstructure of the ship, and tried to and had quite a time getting through the people to get down to my cabin to get the charts, and I eventually said to make it easier for myself, I said, we're heading for a minefield, and I've got to get the chart that shows us how to get through, and so they sort of parted like the Red Sea, and I got through and got the charts. And with all those people on board, the ship, of course, was filthy dirty, as well as empty of food and fuel, and to give the authorities their due, even at this most critical time of the year, when they usually just refuel and went right out to sea again, as I recall, they gave us, I think, either 24 or 48 hours just to clean the ship up and make it habitable again.
That's a dramatic rescue. Yeah. We were criticized for that, and I've forgotten for what. Can you remember? Frank Caldwell brought this out in his tape. Did you leave some there? Some survivors?
No. I know some dead corpses we threw back into the sea because we didn't think there was room for them.
No.
I don't know whether... but I don't...
I must check the Caldwell tape.
Yes, I honestly don't recall.
No.
But I remember we got in, at about 6 o'clock in the morning, the following morning, into Greenock, and an old... dugout retired captain appeared and there's a big escort for all these people and so on, and I remember he said to Harry the Wolf, I believe you've got the lot, and Harry said, yes we have.
Yeah. From another tape, I guess Caldwell's or Harry the Wolf's, you got air cover, there was an aircraft circling you.
Yes, there was I think that was the occasion. We eventually told them that these people were, a lot of them were Germans and Italians, and he said that sent back how bloody funny or something like that.
Yeah.
And then as the lights flashed and we got more exchange and the plane said to us, are you a Canadian ship? And we said yes, and his reply I remember was, well, I'm a salmon belly myself.
Really? Yeah. I've not heard the expression salmon belly before. Yeah. Is that
Well, salmon belly is the name of a lacrosse team in somewhere around here, and perhaps in Vancouver, or was years
I
ago.
I see, yeah. Because if you'd said blue nose, I would have known. Yes. Salmon belly, I haven't heard. After you dropped them, where did you go?
Well, then we started going round the north of Scotland to the other side of Scotland, the Firth of Forth, and we were based in Rosyth, and we took convoys up the northeast coast of Scotland through Pentland Firth, down through the Minches, all those islands with funny names like Rum and Egg and so forth, and then out to about longitude 15 or 20 west, where the U-boat zone ended. After they were all fairly close into the UK, and then we did the same thing back again. And that went on for several months, and in the course of that, we had a change of captain. Herbert Rayner relieved Harry de Wolfe, and he was a lieutenant in command of a destroyer, whereas, you know, and shortly afterwards they made him an acting lieutenant commander, and as you remember, everybody was an acting lieutenant commander if you were a skipper of a destroyer from then on, if they weren't already confirmed in the rank.
How old would Herbie be when he got command? He was not young, as some of the later ones were.
Oh, no, he would have been about 30, I would think.
Yeah. Ancient,
and he was a senior lieutenant. I think he only had about a year to go before, or less, before he would have got his promotion automatically.
Talk about Herbie as captain.
Well, he was very inexperienced in command. He'd been a torpedo officer, and he'd had a very good record academically in the Navy, and he'd been first lieutenant of a schooner during the Royal visit, so he must have been sort of picked for that. But he didn't have the touch for ship handling, and was always running into things, and would almost freeze at the controls. But the great thing about him was that he had a cool temperament. He didn't get too excited about it all, but he felt so terribly sort of ashamed of himself, and he simply, he always made a mess of coming alongside or handling the ship and that sort of thing, and you had to sort of cheer him up afterwards. He felt so badly about it, and the ship's company were, of course, after a super efficient de Wolfe, were rather aghast at this fellow, and Rayner, and they thought the ship was going to come a cropper. They thought they were in for big trouble with such a man in command. But Rayner was a profound man, and a deep thinker, but of a slow and plodding personality, and by guts and determination, he eventually got into his stride, and after 6 months of other wild goings on, he settled down and was just probably as efficient as the average destroyer captain.
Did you do much with Herbie in command in the way of, well, just convoys, I guess?
Yes, we were in convoys all the time, and we had some actions with U-boats, mostly ineffectual way, picking up survivors, because the escort was so small, and the U-boats had started to work in packs, and we got rather used to seeing ships sunk and not being able to do much about it, and there was a British sloop, one of the escorts, she got her stern blown off, and then we tried to take her in tow, and she sank on us, and nothing seemed to go very well. And then in December 19, I took over as first lieutenant from Frank Caldwell in November 1940, and I think my first trip out to sea, we had, as you might expect from that time of year, very bad weather. And then we had escorted one convoy out to the usual western approaches, and were on our way back, and they had radio silence at that time so extreme that it hurt us more than the enemy, and we stumbled on a convoy of about 40 or 50 ships accidentally. We didn't even know they were there. They were ahead in their progress and hadn't reported it. It was the nature of the war. They got smart and they wouldn't have had an unescorted convoy get right into the U-boat zone without saying so. So we arrived at this convoy at about the same time as the five or six U-boats, and I think they sank 19 ships in the course of the night, and again we were picking up survivors, as late at night, and Herbert Rayner, as usual, was very calm under duress, and I remember we picked up the entire crew of a tanker called the Conch.
C-O-N-C-H.
Yes, and then I saw the captain came aboard with his four stripes, and I thought, well, maybe he could tell us something about what's going on in the tactical situation. So I took him up to the bridge, and this was in the middle of the night, and I shouted out to Rayner. I said, "Captain, sir, I have the captain of this ship with the survivors we've just picked up. Maybe he can tell you something." And Rayner turned around and put his hand out to shake hands with this man as if he was receiving guests at a cocktail party.
Yes.
Always very calm and collected. But then the next morning at dawn, by God, we saw a U-boat on the surface, which turned out to be the Italian U-boat Tarantini, or Tina, if I got the name right, and there was a British destroyer called the Viscount appeared from somewhere or other, and we attacked this U-boat. I personally sighted from a bridge myself from the few times during the war you ever saw a U-boat on the surface, and at the time we were credited with the probable destruction of the U-boat, but in fact she was damaged and got back to her base. But Herbert Rayner and Bob Welland, who was the anti-submarine officer, were both decorated, as were a couple of members of the ship's company.
Oh, that's where Rayner got his DSC?
Yes.
And Welland got a DSC? Is that where he got his DSC?
Yes. So that was, you know, a very heartening thing. And so many Canadian naval historians seem to be preoccupied with defeat, or even naval officers serving are preoccupied with defeat, whereas you know, I've always been for success and victory myself, and took part in later on in the war in some highly successful actions against U-boats, and this was the first time that a Canadian ship had been in action with a U-boat, we came off pretty well on it, and at least severely damaged this U-boat. But I read an account in that otherwise excellent book, North Atlantic Run, by Mark Milner, and all he talked about was the Skeena having her bows blown off by a U-boat at about the same time, but no mention of this relatively successful action that we'd had against this Italian submarine.
There's probably a legitimate criticism in the best sense of the word. We do tend to dwell on defeats rather than victories. Because Welland, I happen to know, he had sought ASDIC training as much as he could, and he found it hard to get it.
That's right.
He taught himself a lot.
Yes.
And so he was the one that carried out that successful attack.
Yes, and he had a good technical brain for that such things, too, and this was a very good.
Can you describe the kill? You ran towards her and she submerged.
Yes, we did the usual things of working together with the Viscount, and one would keep contact and the other would attack, and then they'd reverse the proceedings. And as I recall, we attacked this submarine for several hours, and then lost contact, as I say, the authorities at the time thought we'd sunk her. It just gave us a probable destruction. And then later that day, there was a British, a Canadian Pacific liner called the Montrose, which was renamed the Forfar, F-O-R-F-A-R, and became an armed merchant cruiser. And she was torpedoed. It was the final episode of this disastrous 24 hours. And we went to pick up her survivors, and we got a few of them. At first, we thought they were Negroes because they were covered in oil. We thought they'd already had some Chinese and the survivors. And I thought, now we're going to get some Negroes. But these poor fellows were all British, and they were they were covered in oil, and I remember they always talk about British understatement. In this occasion, there was a masterpiece, because one of the people we picked up, there were about four of them sitting on a small square raft, not much larger than a card table, and covered in oil, and one of them turned out to be the purser, a man of 50 or so, he was exhausted. They would have been dead if we hadn't found them within an hour or two, and because it was terribly cold, so we got to help them scrub some of the oil off him and gave him a couple of shots of rum, and he made an observation. He said, "You know, there's no comfort on one of those rafts."
The person's like the comfort. Your time in Saint-Laurent's
but
coming
I'd
to an end.
I'd another note in passing on that trip. We had no medical officer in the ship, and I was, I must say, later on, I was in favor of a ship of that size with a ship's company of 200 or so. It was very worthwhile to have a medical officer. We didn't have one. All we had was a sick berth attendant, and one officer we had named George Brown, who was a very good, became a friend of mine later. He was in hospital he wasn't in hospital. He was obviously getting a bad case of flu. And as the greenhorn first lieutenant, I said to George, "You've got to go ashore to the hospital. We can't take you to sea." But he was afraid he'd be left behind in England and we'd go to Canada without him or something. So. Stupidly and from inexperience, I said, "Okay, well, stay aboard." And this was.